This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Julie Hurwitz and I, Marjorie Cohn, are joined by Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink and co-author of the new book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict.
There's a lot of information out there about the war in Ukraine, but not enough about the path to peace.
On the domestic front, we'll talk about disengaging from violent far-right extremism, a problem that is also reaching into the ranks of law enforcement and the military.
Patrick Rickards will be joining us to talk about Life After Hate, an organization dedicated to helping individuals disengage from violent far-right hate groups.
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
Since February 24th, 2022, the day that Russia illegally invaded Ukraine, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians and Russians have been killed or otherwise become casualties. 8 million Ukrainians have been forced to flee their homes, and hundreds of thousands of Russians have fled conscription. Millions of people in Ukraine have no heat, electricity, or water, and temperatures are below freezing. The war has devastated 35% of Ukraine's economy. Western sanctions on Russia have led to skyrocketing inflation in Europe, and a dangerous squeeze on energy supplies is crippling manufacturing. The war has also devastated infrastructure, reduced electrical grids, railways, apartment buildings, and oil depots to rubble. It has filled the air with pollutants and toxic waste that is contaminating rivers and groundwater. The war is also exacerbating the climate crisis. The fossil fuel industry is profiting from the sanctions, which provide it with an excuse to increase dirty energy exploration and production. The Western media portrays the war as a conflict between the evil empire Russia and the innocent Ukraine. Lost in the heartbreaking images, however, is a nuanced understanding of the context for the war, what caused it, and how it can be ended. The role of the United States in the historical backdrop to the war and the current U.S. resistance to a peaceful settlement are absent from the coverage in the corporate and even much of the alternative media. Here to help my co-host Julie Hurwitz and me, Marjorie Cohn, unpack this complex situation is Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin, who has co-authored with Nicholas Davies the new book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. Medea is one of the leading activists of our time. Wherever people are hurting, we can expect to see Medea and Code Pink there. We are lucky to have Medea with us today. Medea Benjamin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Nice to be on with you.
Medea, you and Nicholas Davies write in your new book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict, quote, "Too many in this administration appear to equate diplomacy, negotiation, and compromise with appeasement and capitulation," unquote. Please explain the divisions in the Biden administration between the neocons and those like Mark Milley who are calling for negotiations.
Yes, it seems that there is quite a division within the administration. You have people like Victoria Nuland, who has been involved around Ukraine from the time of the Bush administration through Obama's, and now in the Biden administration. She is part of the a neocon group that think that the U.S. must confront Russia, that the NATO enlargement was a good thing, that there is no talking to Putin because Ukraine can win this war. On the other hand, you have people like the number one advisor to Biden in the military, Mark Milley, the chair of the Joint Chief of Staff, who came out very publicly, quite amazingly, saying that the Ukrainians had done a great job fighting the Russian invasion, but there would not be a victory on the battlefield, and so this was a good time for negotiations. So this internal division, I think, is playing itself out and is one of the things that is holding back the Biden administration from both pushing Ukraine to negotiating and to beginning some real negotiations between the Biden administration and Russia, not on smaller issues like this prisoner swap that we just saw with Brittany Griner, but on the larger issues of the war.
Medea, in light of those recent comments and the conflicts you pointed out within the Biden administration, what effect do you think the Republicans taking over the House of Representatives in January will have on this question and on the future U.S. military assistance to Ukraine?
I think it's going to open up the space for discussion. I think the House will have hearings on this issue. I think there will be calls for greater accountability for where all this money is ending up. In terms of actually stopping the flow of money, I doubt that will happen because the majority of Democrats and Republicans will want to keep that going. But the fact that there will be more open discussion, that more Republicans will probably vote against things like this latest request for $37 billion for Ukraine, gives a chance to really start talking about where is this going? Will there be a blank check for Ukraine and for how long?
On October 24th, 30 members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus signed a letter to Biden calling for direct talks with Russia and vigorous diplomatic efforts in support of a negotiated settlement and ceasefire. But in an alarming about-face, they withdrew the letter the next day. Why did they back down, and how can we get them back on track?
Well, Marjorie, I think this is an absolutely critical question because it was shameful that only 30 members of the Progressive Caucus signed on to a very mild letter calling for negotiations. And then the fact that they were lambasted by people within their own party and backed down within 24 hours is really appalling. I think they backed down because they were getting pressure from people like Nancy Pelosi. The elections were coming up just a few weeks away. They were accused of looking like they were supporting the extreme right in the Republican Party, who were calling for negotiations. Whatever the reason that they backed down, we have to get them back on track. I think the one person who did not disavow his signing of that letter was Congressman Ro Khanna, who said on CNN that it was a rational letter, that it was a rational call for negotiations, and he got a lot of support for that. So I think as we move forward in the new Congress, we have to get those progressives back into that position. We can't have people like Barbara Lee and the Squad not calling for negotiations. It just doesn't make sense at all. So I think it's important that people who live in the districts of those 30 people who signed on go back to them and say, we were happy that you signed on that letter. We want you to put out something now, whether it's individually or collectively, saying that you do believe in negotiations. And it's interesting, Marjorie, that it seems like that letter was not something that the administration had a problem with. So getting them back on track so it's not just Republicans and particularly right-wing Republicans like Marjorie Taylor Greene who are calling for peace talks, but that it's coming from within the Democratic Party itself.
French President Emmanuel Macron recently said that Russia has legitimate security concerns. What are the issues you view that would have to be addressed in any peace negotiations if they go forward?
Well, yes, I think it's good that Macron did say this, because it's not something we hear in the United States. In fact, it's poo-pooed that the expansion of NATO had anything to do with this war, when we have so much evidence that we talk about extensively in our book of people who had warned that this invasion or this conflict was going to come to a head if the issue of NATO's expansion was not addressed. And key to that is the issue of neutrality for Ukraine. This is something that Zelensky himself actually admitted at one time early on in the war, saying that it looked like their dream of joining NATO was going to have to be discarded. Now, unfortunately, he is saying that they want to be fast-tracked into NATO. This is a bottom line for Russia. There has to be an agreement that includes neutrality, includes Russia's concern about the expansion of NATO, Russia's concern about the not just NATO, but the U.S. bases, like the base in Poland, just 100 miles from its border, Russia's concern about the nuclear weapons that are in Belgium, Germany, Italy, Netherlands, Turkey. These all have to be discussed. And unfortunately, with the U.S. having pulled out of some of the nuclear agreements with Russia, those have to be back on the table again.
There is sort of this mass understanding of this conflict, with the starting point being Russia engaged in an unprovoked invasion and attack on Ukraine. And that's always like the starting point for any conversation about what's going on there. We can't really deny that that's true. So how do we sort of get past that to be able to address the underlying reality of what you're talking about?
Well, first we can and must deny that that's true, because we must say that it's unjustified, and unjustified on all kinds of levels, from the UN Charter to the Kellogg-Briand Act to the just basic issues of morality. But we must say that it is provoked, and that is something we go into great detail in our book. And certainly you must recognize that this war didn't fall from the sky, that there are elements that have been building up for years that foretold this war, and the U.S. paid no attention to it and summarily dismissed the proposals that Russia kept putting forward as late as December of last year. So we have to be clear that there were provocations. And then from there, the issue becomes one that people say you cannot talk to Putin. And I think we have to address that directly. We just have a prisoner swap that happened. So obviously somebody is talking to Putin. There have been talks around the grain deal to get the grain out of the country to countries that depended upon it. There have been talks about getting the International Atomic Energy Agency into the nuclear plant so they wouldn't blow up. There have been other prisoner swaps that we don't hear about, but there have been probably almost two dozen of them, which is very difficult to pull off, but they have been happening. I think we have to dispel this myth that you can't talk to the Russians, and to say that we have to build on the talks that have been happening. The Turkish government has been very instrumental in those talks and should be enlisted to broaden those talks. But yes, it is essential that people understand, while it is an unjustified invasion, it was provoked, and if we move towards discussions, it can move us in the direction of dealing with those issues that were part of the provocation.
Yes, unfortunately, we hear all too little of this more nuanced analysis in both the corporate and much of the alternative media. So good for you and Code Pink, Medea, for raising these issues and putting them front and center in the national discourse. Hungary vetoed a $19 billion loan to Ukraine from the European Union. What are the ramifications of this split in the EU?
Well, there are a number of questions about why Hungary did this. Some say that they want to get money that the EU is holding up for Hungary because it hasn't come through on reforms around the corruption that exists there. In any case, it shows the divisions in Europe. In Hungary, there was a poll that was taken that showed over 90% of the Hungarian people wanted to see peace talks. The Hungarian government has also been against the sanctions on Russia, has not agreed to abide by those sanctions, says that it's responsible for the incredible inflation that Europe is facing. So I think these divisions are going to get even greater as time goes by, with the Europeans really being hit by the sanctions to a greater degree than the Russians are. We see large protests in numerous countries in Europe that are against inflation and connecting it to the war in Ukraine. We see more calls by coming from the base of telling the European leaders that they better figure out a way to end this war and stop the negative effects that this war is happening on the lives of ordinary people in Europe. It's also causing a split in many European countries now, where they are looking at how the United States companies, both the energy companies and the weapons companies, are actually profiting from this war, selling energy to Europe at four times the cost it is in the United States, pushing the Europeans to spend more money on weapons, and that money goes to U.S. weapons companies. So we will see an increasing division as this moves forward if it doesn't go to the peace table.
Shifting just a little bit, could you tell our listeners about the Christmas truce that U.S. faith-based leaders are calling for?
Well, this is really moving us towards this idea of pushing the Biden administration more to call for peace talks. And we thought it was very important, especially in light of the grief that those 30 members of Congress got when they called for negotiations, to put this on the moral playing field and to get members of the faith-based community, including people that had gone to the inauguration of President Biden and have contacts in the White House, getting at them on record of calling for a Christmas truce that harkens back to the World War I 1914 truce, when the soldiers put down their weapons and fraternized, playing soccer together, sharing meals, singing Christmas carols. We put out this call in the U.S. together with the Fellowship in Reconciliation and the National Council of Elders and the Peace in Ukraine Coalition, and over 800 faith-based leaders, from Reverend Barber of the Poor People's Campaign to Jesse Jackson, members of the National Council of Churches, Jewish leaders, Muslim leaders. It's fantastic the kind of support that this has gotten, and as part of it, they are asking for a meeting in the White House. So we're very excited about this letter. It will come out probably next week, and we hope that it will help to change the equation.
Julie Hurwitz and I, Marjorie Cohn, are here talking with Code Pink's Medea Benjamin about achieving peace in Ukraine. Medea, this is the first time since World War II that there has been talk about using nuclear weapons in an ongoing war. If this is a proxy war and the U.S. and Russia combined have nearly 13,000 of the world's 14,000 nuclear weapons, we are facing an existential danger. To what extent is the West's role in encouraging Ukraine to reject talks with Russia exacerbating the possibility of nuclear war the longer the war continues?
Well, absolutely. And we're seeing, for example, when that missile landed in Poland, and originally it was reported that it came from Russia, and Zelensky insisted it came from Russia. That was a possible trigger for the Article 5 of NATO, calling on all countries to support a NATO country that was attacked. And fortunately, that missile did not come from Russia, but it could very well have, and it could in the future, as it's very possible that there be accidents. We also saw the most recent incident of Ukraine using drones to strike bases inside Russia. Some say this is an attempt to get NATO directly involved, since it is not very plausible that Ukraine carried out that attack without some intelligence assistance from the U.S. These kind of things are going to keep happening as the war drags on, and each incident will lead us closer to a direct confrontation with Russia. And as you said, between Russia and the U.S., having this level of nuclear capability is extremely dangerous. I know that Biden only mentioned once the possibility of nuclear Armageddon, not when he was addressing the American people, but at a fundraiser. And I think it is important that the American people understand just how dangerous this situation is. And I think if they did, if it was talked about more, they would be much more in favor of negotiations. Right now, there are so many people who say Putin is a maniac, Putin can't be talked to, and yet they somehow dismiss that Putin would use a nuclear weapon. I think if Putin keeps getting pushed and pushed, and indeed if NATO gets involved, there is a real chance that he would use nuclear weapon, and we should be aware of that and do everything we can to prevent it by pushing for an end to this conflict.
Medea, you referenced a few moments ago, and you write in your book about the military and economic aid that's coming from the United States. In fact, you point out that Congress has authorized $40 billion in military and economic aid to Ukraine. Could you talk a little bit more about the impact this has and how the weapons manufacturers are in fact profiting from this war?
Well, I'm very, very concerned about how this war is just ballooning the militarization of our country as we face a Pentagon budget that's coming close to $1 billion, and then the money for Ukraine is separate from that, and will, if this $37 billion is passed before the end of the year, we will have spent over $100 billion on Ukraine. You know, we are in this situation where we never have to be questioning where is the money for war coming from. The weapons manufacturers have so much of a stronghold in our Congress and in the White House and this revolving door. Let's remember that the Secretary of Defense himself came directly from the board of Raytheon. They are raking in the money from this, and they're also changing the rules of the game in a new amendment to the National Defense Appropriations Act that will allow for military contracts and no bid contracts that are multi-year, so they don't have to continue to be approved. And they're using the justification of Ukraine, saying we are depleting our weapons that we've sent, and we have to know for the next decade how much money we're going to have so that these weapons manufacturers can be assured of their profits. So this is a tremendous increase in militarization, and I think it should give pause to people to realize that how much they are benefiting them and how much they're changing the rules of the game so that they will continue to benefit for years to come.
And of course, we're constantly told that there's no money for education or healthcare or infrastructure. And meanwhile, both parties never saw a proposal for military appropriations that they didn't like. There are protests against the war throughout Europe and around the world. Why aren't there anti-war demonstrations in the United States? And what can our listeners do to help promote an immediate ceasefire and peace negotiations, Medea?
Well, it's something I ask myself every day, Marjorie. Why aren't we able to get significant numbers of people out? We are working in that direction. For example, in New York City, there is a call for a large demonstration on January 14th relating this to Martin Luther King Day and his call for a demilitarization back then at the time of the Vietnam War. There is this Peace in Ukraine coalition that people can look at online. Peaceinukraine.org meets every 2 weeks and calls for actions. Right now, some of those actions include just going out to places like your farmer's market with a sign saying, let's talk about Ukraine, and getting people to sign up for the peace talks. We have sample flyers, petitions, sign-up sheets, all kinds of things on that website. We're also trying to get new sectors involved. You just said, Marjorie, how there's always money for war. We feel that the environmental movement should be right out there with us in this anti-war call, because that $100 billion we're putting into Ukraine should be put into funds to address the climate crisis. And there are so many reasons why this war is particularly disastrous for the climate, not only what's the destruction in Ukraine, the methane gas that was released when the Nord Stream pipeline blew up, the possibility of a blow-up of the nuclear power plants that would send radiation all over. But really, so many reasons to join the environment and anti-war movements together. So we're working towards that, and there's great information about that on the Peace in Ukraine website as well. So I would just say in general that as I travel around the country on a 50-city book tour, I'm finding people want to talk about this issue when they get more clarity that negotiations and peace talks would actually be the best thing for the people of Ukraine as well as this planet, where people are being affected by this war all over, that this is something more and more people do want to join. So I hope some of your listeners will join us, because the sooner we build up an anti-war movement that's effective in this country, the sooner our government will be pushing for negotiations.
This is such an important conversation, and I just want to thank you for helping to shed light on so much of the misinformation that this country is operating under with respect to this war. How can our listeners follow the work that you and Code Pink are, and your co-author, Nicholas Davies, are doing on this critically important issue?
Well, I would say get a copy of the book. I find that people, as I'm traveling, are buying them for their holiday gifts to relatives who don't agree with them. They say it's not the gift they want, but it's the gift they need. And there's also an 18-minute video that we did explaining the basics about this war, including NATO expansion and the U.S. involvement in the 2014 coup in Ukraine. They can get that on the Code Pink website. So we have a lot of good materials for people to break through the fog of war and get more confident in their own positions on this, and then use that to convince others.
Well, Medea Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us today on Law and Disorder and elaborating on these really important issues vis-a-vis the war in Ukraine and what people can do to actually facilitate a peaceful settlement.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Since 2019, the number of white nationalist networks in the United States has been declining. More centralized ones, however, are supplanting them. An example of this, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, is how founders of the podcast platform The Right Stuff have switched from organizing pool party groups to focusing on building the racist and anti-Semitic National Justice Party. Many prominent leaders in this new iteration of white nationalism say their primary goal is to challenge Conservativism, Inc. Live streamer Nick Fuentes is one. Fuentes recently dined with Donald Trump and Kanye West at Mar-a-Lago and was present outside the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Fuentes seeks to harness the grievances of Trump supporters into an overtly ethno-nationalist political movement, forming the Republican Party's core. Ideas once confined to the organized white power movement are now openly discussed within the broader political right. The so-called Great Replacement conspiracy, holding that white people are being systematically replaced across the Western world by multiculturalists and Jews, is routinely cited as a reality by some elected officials and media pundits. Today on Law and Disorder, we're delighted to welcome Patrick Rickards. He is the CEO of Life After Hate, an organization helping people leave the violent far right. Founded in 2011 by former violent extremists, it's the only nationally recognized and federally funded nonprofit positioned to assist those wishing to disengage from violent far right extremism. An expert in education, Patrick also founded the Driving Force Institute for Public Engagement, an initiative aimed at transforming how U.S. history and civics are taught. An award-winning writer, Patrick serves on the boards of several nonprofits.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, what is violent far-right extremism, and is this a new phenomenon?
Unfortunately, it's not a new phenomenon. It's been around for more than a century. I mean, this is an idea here in the United States that was essentially given birth when the Ku Klux Klan was created, and has continued throughout our nation's history. It has to be very clear, when we talk about the far right, we're not talking about anything political. This has nothing to do with MAGA. This has nothing to do with anything else that we deal with in this country. These are ideological views. These are those who are on the far right, those who are on totalitarian envisions, those who are part of, you know, who believe in Nazi views. That's what we mean when we talk about the far right. And it becomes very important, as you've noted, is to distinguish between violent extremism and extremism. I can tell you, somebody who spends his days working in violent far right extremism, we're not talking about your grandmother sharing articles from Fox News. We're not even talking about people who are posting things from 4chan on the social media. We're talking about those who are taking violent action. You think back to the 1990s, the early aughts, when you had neo-Nazis in the streets that were causing trouble. That was the VFRE. When you think about the siege in Charlottesville, that was the VFRE. When you think about the atrocities in January 6th, that is the VFRE. It's what we associate today with groups like Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and such, but it's something that's been part of our nation's history, a stain on our nation's history, I should say, for a century and a half now.
Patrick, when you say VFRE...
talking about violent far-right extremism. All of those things that give those who believe in civil liberties and want to protect what makes this country so great, those things that give us nightmares at night. Those people who are trying to shut down differences, those people who are taking violent actions to keep people from having their voice, from having their expression, from living the lives that they're entitled to here in the United States.
Patrick, I am fascinated with the work that you do. Can you tell us a bit about the violence intervention field generally and about Life After Hate specifically? Is this a new specialization and is it growing?
It is. It is a new specialization and it is indeed growing. Life After Hate was actually created about 11 years ago. And we were the very first organization in the United States that was talking about this sort of rehabilitation. As an organization, we were created by a number of individuals who themselves had lived lives in violent far-right extremism. And for one reason or another, usually because they were getting out of prison, they decided it was a life that they needed to leave behind. They created Life After Hate as a way to help each other, to support each other, to share stories, to be there for each other. And over the years, that has continued to grow. Interestingly, so for those who are part of a life of violent far-right extremism and end up needing to exit, needing to leave that life, they're now known as formers. They are former extremists. And an organization like ours is designed to help them become formers, to give them the supports, to give them the counseling, to give them the guidance, to give them the vision to get there. Interestingly, I am the first CEO of Life After Hate who is not a former. For 11 years now, the people who have headed this organization have all lived that life. That's not me. I am an advocate. I'm a public engagement specialist. I'm a nonprofit executive. And that was intentional, because what we've seen, even though this is a new space, the space is getting more complicated. It's getting more complex. The needs are there. We can go into how someone gets into a life of violent far-right extremism, but when you talk about how does one exit, it's not an easy process. This is complicated. This is, when you think of how somebody gives up a life of alcohol, for instance, that's a complicated process. It requires a lot of steps. The same is true from exiting violent extremism. And it's one of those things, as we started as an organization, we were focused largely on peer support. How could one former extremist help another former extremist? Where we are now is recognizing that when we look at the exit services we provide, you really are providing services as a professional mental health organization. And so now we have an entire team of individuals, clinical psychologists, licensed social workers, who work with individuals as they go through this process. And so there's a lot of that counseling with those licensed professionals. There's work with our exit specialists, those individuals who are themselves formers, who can share those peer experiences and give you those necessary supports. And then we provide all sorts of benefits from discussion groups and peer support groups and online forums and the like to really help individuals navigate this process. It is incredibly complicated. It is incredibly messy. It's also one of those things that, quite honestly, if you're looking to leave an extremist group, it can also be something that threatens your very existence. If those members of your group find out you're looking to leave the movement, you put yourself at risk. And so we have to take all of that into account and really provide a process that for some individuals can take years. But how do we help them take accountability for what they've done in the past? Because most of them have done some really ugly things. How do you take accountability for that? How do you begin on the path where you're gaining redemption? You're gaining that second chance. You're proving yourself that you can re-enter society and be a productive member of it.
Patrick, I understand how complex this is, but looking on your website, I just have to ask briefly. One of your presentations is titled The Breeding Ground for Extremism. Can you briefly list some of the factors that allow tendencies of hate to flourish?
Sure. It surprises a lot of people, but when you, especially those that we work with. Ideology is not the first thing that draws somebody to extremism. Usually what you see is you find people who are disaffected. You find individuals who don't feel that people understand them. They don't feel that they fit in. They don't see a part of themselves in the lives that they're living. They're looking for something else. And those extremist groups are incredibly sophisticated in figuring out how to prey on those characteristics. How to find those individuals. At first we were doing it in person, now you're doing it online. How do you find those individuals that are having those doubts, that are seeking a place of belonging, and offering hope to them? And so what you often see, if we were having this conversation in the 1990s or the early aughts, you would see recruits being pulled in through music, through death metal, through the sort of things you can only imagine. Now you're seeing it through video games, you're seeing it through online chat pages and those sorts of things. But again, it's building up one's personality. It's imagine recruiting a 16-year-old boy who doesn't feel that anybody understands him. He spends his entire life online on Twitch playing shooter games. And these extremist organizations will go on Twitch and they will support, they will encourage these individuals, tell them how strong their gaming skills are, how terrific they are. They'll chat them up as they're playing, where you can have conversations online. All of a sudden, that young man feels somebody finally understands them. He feels there's a place for him to belong. Here they get what he's bringing in terms of his gaming skills, in terms of what he's interested in. And then over time, they suck them in, and you have these individuals that they finally believe they belong. They've given up their old families. They've given up their old teachers, their old classmates, their old lives. They're now living within this organization. That's their family. And over time, then, they have to adopt that ideology. They have to begin to say the same things. They have to begin to do the same things. And that then pulls you into a life that you then can never get out of. That's when the ideological beliefs really start to fester. That's when you start believing your own hype. You believe the things that you're saying. And, you know, over time, it becomes, there's no other choice for you. Civil society has rejected you. We don't want Nazis. And now you believe this is the only community that will ever truly understand you and accept you for who you are. And you just get deeper and deeper and deeper into the thinking. It becomes quite frightening.
It sounds like the mafia. You know, you talk about gaming, you talk about music, and how those tend to pull people in who start out as disaffected to begin with. I would imagine that social media in general and the sort of epidemic of misinformation that is now dominating must play a very significant role in drawing those people into that community.
Social media has provided not just a new hunting ground, but has provided for a new army that really can make violent extremism much stronger than it's ever been before. You know, we all know, you know, when you're talking about those, you know, most that are entering these worlds of extremism are doing so in their teen years. They're individuals that are staying online. And it doesn't matter what platforms they're on. If you're on a gaming platform like Twitch, they'll find you. If you're on TikTok, they'll find you. If you're on message boards, they'll find you. And they know exactly how to hunt for individuals who have that weakness, who are seeking that belonging, and they know how to pull them in. And what you also see, though, is, you know, you see, if you look at the extremist groups across the United States, they've almost, you had mentioned earlier that this can be like the mafia. And in many ways, I will joke that when you look at how the world of extremism is divided, it's divided in many ways like the five families in The Godfather, in that each one of these organizations, they develop a specialty. You have some organizations that are particularly adept at recruitment, others that are adept at raising money, others that serve as the legal teams where you have the Nazis in suits and ties. You have other individuals, other groups that are particularly good at the propaganda, and then others still, like our good old Proud Boys, that are the muscle. And each of these organizations plays a role in perpetuating extremism and taking action across the United States, and they know how to recruit the individuals that are best served for their purposes. You know, before, you know, again, you were talking 10, 15 years ago, you're talking about organizations that were largely recruiting extremist soldiers to take very physical, personal acts. Now you're looking for individuals who are particularly adept behind the keyboard. You know, those that can not only recruit but can cause some of the chaos and the problems that these organizations seek to do without ever having to leave the privacy of their parents' basement.
During the January 6, 2021 insurrection, at least 19 defendants were current or former police officers. More than 80 rioters were veterans or active service members. I understand that the threat of white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement has been noted by the FBI, but we don't have a national strategy to combat it. Can you talk a bit about this dilemma?
Sure. I think there's no doubt if we look over the last two decades, we can see that there's infiltration by violent extremists in law enforcement. We can also see that there's infiltration within the military. And it's one of those, it shouldn't surprise us. When we think about the ideology, you think about how one is trained. You think about the military, for instance, and a veteran of the armed forces was trained not only to kill, but was trained to hate certain things. You're trained, you know, you were going after Islamists over the last 25 years. That becomes something that these groups are able to prey upon. I think that when you talk about our inability to have a national strategy, you're absolutely correct. You know, it's one of those things, you can go back and you can look at popular television programs like West Wing. Season one of West Wing was produced in 1999. You had political experts that were advisors to that program. In that first season in 1999, we all forget, the plot line was focused on the fact that you had violent white supremacists in the United States who were the single most clear and present danger to our nation. And literally we're going after the president and his family in that season. We knew this was a problem. We've known this is a problem for decades. I think the challenge we have is really being willing to first identify what the problem is. You know, you look now, you look across the country, you look at these actions that have happened. You look at the Tops grocery shooting in Buffalo. You look at the most recent shooting in Colorado Springs at the nightclub. You look at shootings we've had just across the country over the last few years. What you often see is you see the same two things that are told in those stories. You see, one, it was a white man. You see, two, that it was an AR-15. And then you see, three, at some point we refer to this as a lone gunman or a lone actor. And the simple fact is we as a nation are unwilling to declare that these are acts of domestic terrorism in the United States. Until we're willing to declare that these are domestic terrorist actions, we're never going to be able to get our hands around the problem. You're never going to be able to develop the strategic plan that you're looking at. Because at the end of the day, we're talking about how to deploy resources. And we've never been more divided as a nation on all sorts of things right now, including how we spend federal tax dollars. And I think we've now, as a nation, have come around to the fact that we are reasonably okay, with some exceptions, we are reasonably okay with spending tax dollars to go after global terrorists, to go after those individuals who threaten the American way of life. And nobody's going to question the amount of dollars we spent going after bin Laden after 9/11, because that was addressing a clear and present danger to our nation. You know, no one's going to question as we go after other terrorists abroad. Half of our country is going to question going after domestic terrorists, because we're going to realize that the terrorists are going to align themselves with a significant half of the population here in the United States. It becomes very difficult to say we're going to go ahead and we're going after these domestic terrorists, and guess what? They share an ideology that many of you also share. That's not something that we're going to embrace. But I think if you want a national strategy, we, one, have to call it what it is, and we have to say these are domestic terrorists. And two, we can't be afraid to put sunshine on the problem. It's why a program like Law and Disorder becomes so important. You all are discussing these issues. We have to be willing to discuss these threats. We can't keep trying to write this off as a once-in-a-lifetime sort of thing, or something that rarely happens, or a lone gunman. This is a growing problem in the United States. We have ideologies that are growing far more distressing and far more violent. We're now arming those ideologies with weapons of mass destruction like we never have before. And then we're not preparing law enforcement to deal with it. We expect law enforcement, whether we're talking about our local police stations or we're talking about the FBI, they're to solve the crime after it happens. We're not, as a nation, saying a part of our job here is to really get in there and try to ensure that these acts of domestic terrorism aren't happening in the first place. When we prevent them, it's almost out of pure luck.
Patrick, I'd like to follow up on that a little bit. I understand that Life After Hate does have some program to train law enforcement on violent right-wing, far-right extremism. And first, what are the goals? But also, to what extent does this program address both addressing how law enforcement responds to VFRE outside its ranks, but also, as part of your program, does it also address how it deals with VFRE within its ranks?
That is an excellent question, and is one that I get all of the time. In fact, when we released our course earlier this fall, we have an online asynchronous course for members of law enforcement, including probation officers, corrections officers, and the like. And it's meant to serve as a 101 course on what is violent far-right extremism. And there are many critics that have pushed back on me, saying we don't need to teach law enforcement what it is. We need to teach them how to stay out of it. And I think that becomes a valid criticism when you look at some of the data that we have. Yes, I mean, mm-hmm. truth be told, it's one of those that actually years ago, Life After Hate received its first grant from the Department of Homeland Security. And then soon after we received it, the Trump administration took it away because they didn't like some of the things the organization was saying. And we've been fortunate over the last few years, though, to work with the Department of Homeland Security under its CP3 program. And this is one of the few things that the federal government is actually trying to do that's really getting at the heart of how can we begin to address issues of domestic terrorism in the United States. And to their credit, DHS realizes that nobody has the solutions yet, but they're able to seed small initiatives to hopefully identify promising practice that we can build on. And so this course that we're working on with law enforcement is part of that work that we are doing with the Department of Homeland Security. We're doing other work where we are engaging with inmates in federal prisons who are serving time for hate crimes to begin the exit process with them. We've been working with mental health professionals to train them on how they can engage with violent extremists and the like. You know, all of this is a start to how you get at it. And it really becomes, you know, what more can we do? Because you're right. I mean, I think particularly when you're talking about dealing with issues like law enforcement, or you're talking about even dealing with veterans, this is not a matter necessarily of just teaching them what it is. I think we all know what it is. I would hope that if you're serving in law enforcement, you understand what violent extremism is in the year 2022. You know, part of what we hope for, what we aspire for, is the ability, how do we create programs, as you're talking about, for those that are in it? How do we create specific counseling programs for U.S. veterans who are now active in violent extremism? How can you create programs for individuals who are current members of law enforcement that want to get out of some of these groups? And to do that, we have to recognize that this is also a mental health issue. And I realize mental health is a stigma within the law enforcement community sometimes as well. But we have to be able to have these sorts of discussions and explore these programs where people can get the mental health services they need to work through it. As you know, we work with members of violent extremism. That is our bread and butter. You know, we've gone through, earlier this fall, we went through all of our cases, all of our charts since 2020, every client our organization has worked with. And the one thing that comes across loud and clear is how important the mental health issues are to all of this. You know, when we look at our clients, more than 70% of our clients come to us with thoughts of suicidal ideation. More than 60% of our clients come to us still wanting to do harm to others. These are very real issues that we have to address. We know that these are issues that law enforcement has to address. These are things that we as a society have to begin to look at real solutions for. And that's what we're doing. I think it's you can't get at violent extremism unless you're going to dive deep into law enforcement on both ends.
And Patrick, we just have a few minutes remaining, but I read the news today that Germany just arrested 25 far-right extremists who were plotting to overthrow the government, and included among those were members of law enforcement, as I understand it. I guess our parting question would have to be, the urgency seems so clear to anyone who reads the newspaper every day. Do you think that the so-called formers, those who have been through programs such as yours at Life After Hate, it seems they would have an important role in standing up to share their experiences, or is that too dangerous for them?
I think that there is no doubt that formers have an important role. We can't ask them to do it alone. And when we ask them to share their role, we have to do it with respect. It's one of those things, if you go to Life After Hate's YouTube channel, for instance, you can see a series of videos that we've produced recently. We just released the last one earlier this week that talks to formers about their experiences, understanding some of the questions you're asking today. What is it that drove you to a life of extremism? What was it like being in one of those groups? What made you want to get out, and what is life like now that you've exited? You know, we too often, as a culture, we like to practice in trauma porn. We love to have formers come and talk to us and tell us about the absolute worst, lowest moments of their lives so that we can judge them, so that we can look at them and shake their head and say, oh, no matter how bad my life's been, at least I've never done that. That is the absolute wrong thing to do. I think when you look at formers are some of the bravest people you're going to find here in the United States. They're individuals who are taking responsibility for some horrendous actions. And each and every day they are asking for our compassion. They are asking for to be rehabilitated. They are asking to be reintegrated into society. That's not an easy thing to do, particularly when you know there's no reason for people to welcome them back. There's nobody who's just saying, hey, if you're a former Nazi, come to us. We'd love to have you. They have to work each and every day to prove themselves again and again. And so I think we need to look to them to provide us some of that inspiration. But at the end of the day, what we need is we need the co-conspirators. We need the individuals like yourselves, like me, who are willing to work with those formers and are willing to make the sort of change, demand the sort of change, take the sort of action that's necessary to bring these changes about. You know, if you're seeing it, we have to address it in law enforcement. We need to demand that national strategy to address it. You know, it's one of those things. When I look at what's going on around us, you know, I get particularly scared. Do I think that the amount of hate crimes are increasing? I don't know. Do I think the number of people who are extremists are increasing? I don't know. But it sure is a whole lot easier to be public about your hate. And we provided everybody there is a flavor of hate for anybody who wants it. You want to hate women, you want to hate blacks, Latinos, immigrants, the government, doesn't matter. We've got a hate for you. And we have to begin to address that. Because I've talked to some people who take great pride in the head of the Proud Boys having to go to jail for January 6th. And it's one of those things, I personally believe all it's going to do is ramp things up. He's going to become a martyr. He's going to be somebody in prison that is going to be worshipped and adored. And his people are going to carry on, and you're going to see splinter groups that are going to break off from the January 6th organizers that are going to continue this push, believe that the government railroaded him. We can't allow that to happen. You know, it's one of those things. We have to, at some point, say that enough is enough. We have to, at some point, say that civil liberties in the United States matter. We have to, at some point, say that there are actions we just, as a civil society, will no longer tolerate. And we seem to be unwilling to do that. We seem to be worrying about offending people. And quite frankly, if I'm going to offend an American Nazi because of what I believe, I'm perfectly comfortable with that.
How do these VFRE people find you? What gets them to you? And over the course of your existence, how many people can you say that you have actually successfully retrained?
Over the years, we have helped thousands upon thousands of individuals who have been part of VFRE, and that doesn't even begin to account for all of the family and friends that are affected by it as well. I think to your question, how do they come? How does a member of violent extremism come to a group like Life After Hate? And be very clear, there are other groups that do great work in this space as well. They come to us in one of two ways. Either they as an individual have hit rock bottom, and they realize that there is a major event. They are getting out of prison. They are trying to avoid prison. Their wife and kids just walked out on them, and they realize that their life needs a change. Or they, as an individual, have also recognized that they no longer quite believe their ideology. They're talking about things. They're saying, these illegal immigrants are stealing jobs for me and my friends, and all of a sudden they realize they don't know a single person who's lost a job to an undocumented immigrant. And they begin, the ideology begins to soften, they begin to question, they start looking for other options.
Patrick, how can listeners read more about your work on the website?
Sure. If you go to our website, lifeafterhate.org, you can find all sorts of things there. We actually have a great team of about 15 people that work on this every day. But if you go to our website, lifeafterhate.org, you can find all you want. You can also find us on Twitter, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us on YouTube.
Patrick Rickards, thank you for your universally important work.
Thank you. You too. Thank you for all you all do.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.